Hi, I'm Gabrielle Hayes, and you found the Cat Dog Fish Cast. I'm joined by my partner in crime, Dr. Chris Tufnell.
Hi, Gab.
A small animal and equine vet who we have lassoed in to help us answer some of the burning questions about owning and acquiring a dog. So today's podcast is devoted to the dog lovers out there, of whom there are many, and we both love our dogs. I don't have a dog right now. But I have in the past, and I hope to have in the future. Chris has two.
We've got two. We've had four. Well, it's been up to four in the past, but we're sadly down to two now.
And Dizzy and Tiggy are what kind of dog?
They're both terriers. They've both got a significant amount of Jack Russell in them. One of them probably has a little bit of Lakeland in them, but they're terriers.
So they're crazy, in other words.
No, they're not. They're really peaceful terriers. Everybody thinks that terriers are yappy. But they're
I've had Jack Russells, and they're bloody insane.
I think it says a little bit more about you than it does the dogs.
I was waiting for that one.
Yeah, no. Dogs, as we know, mirror their owners. So if your dog's an idiot,
that is an absolute low blow. Well, we have just completely taken this podcast to a new level. One that I think we're quite comfortable in.
So maybe choose what sort of dog you have very carefully.
Yeah, okay. Anyway, I'm going to be asking you some questions, and you as the expert in the room, of course it's a very small room.
In the room.
Yeah, are going to help answer questions. We're going to start with, before you own a dog, and if you're thinking about owning a dog, and I'm going to say these questions are going to be from the perspective of a city dweller. If you live in a city and you want to own a dog, as I would love to do, I'm desperate to own a greyhound, but I don't quite think that is appropriate for the size of flat I live in. Anyway, I have some questions, and we've also, some of our listeners have emailed in questions, and thank you very much for that. Actually, we did get a question in from Jennifer, who lives in East London, and she asked, is a dog in the city more or less healthy than a dog living in the country?
So I think that it would be a very broad brush statement to say one way or t'other there. So I'm going to be very political about it, in that it really depends on how you keep it. So I think it would be perfectly possible to keep a dog in the country and have it far less healthy than a dog in the city. So let's get back to basics here. What do dogs need? They need good food, enough of it, but not too much of it. They need fresh water. They need exercise, and they need some companionship because they're a pack animal. So there are very few solitary. In fact, I'm not sure if I can think of any breed that strictly is a solitary animal, because they've all evolved from wolves.
What about those ones that are the smartest breed, and they border collies?
Yeah, a border collie is actually no. Border collies aren't solitary. Sadly, they're racist. I mean, genuinely, I mean this. I mean, I know a lot of border collies that like border collies, don't like any other breed. They'll happily exist with other border collies. I don't know whether it's a
discrimination. Perfect for our times.
It could be
a
discrimination based on intellect. They might be looking at other dogs and thinking that they're all a bit stupid and they don't like them. I don't know. But the truth is, even border collies are pack animals at heart. So you will have dogs that will settle into being solitary dogs, but mainly because they see us as part of their pack. So that the reason they're happy to be a dog on their own is that they don't feel they're on their own.
Okay.
So if you look at those requirements, really, and then obviously there are requirements within with regards to sort of comfort and temperature and things, then from a health point of view, it's meeting those requirements which is more important than being in the city or in a rural area. It's arguably easier to take them out for lovely walks and give them the exercise they need in rural areas than it is the city. But otherwise, I can't see it's very much how you keep them.
What about pollution, though?
Well, that's really interesting, because if you walk your dog along the street and you're right next door to the road, then it's highly likely that it's inhaling a lot of particulates. Those are the big bits of pollution that come out generally out of diesel cars, but they can come out of and vans and lorries, and they're quite heavy, so they do hang down, and so kids in pushchairs and dogs on leads definitely will inhale more of them. But actually, because they are quite heavy,
kids in pushchairs.
Yeah, no, absolutely, seriously. But because they are quite heavy, you can actually avoid them, or not avoid them completely, but reduce your inhalation of them by moving away from the road, walking along less busy roads, so taking routes through parks and on less busy roads, not walking alongside the flow of traffic, particularly if it's slow moving, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. certainly not walking alongside it if it's moving up a hill and slow moving up a hill, because it'll be chuffing out loads of waste. So you can think about that. As far as general air pollution is concerned, that's very much down to the environment. Interestingly, everybody in rural areas probably feels a little bit smug, but sometimes
in general,
sometimes the air pollution is actually worse 50 miles outside the city, because it goes up in a big plume from the city and then falls back down in rural areas about sort of 50 miles out. So
right where you live, in
other
words.
Potentially. So you can't guarantee your air pollution, just because when you look around you, you've got woods and trees and things. It may be that your air pollution levels are higher than you think. So you're absolutely right. I think air pollution probably affects dogs and cats as much as it does us. But you can certainly, from the point of view of the really dangerous stuff, the particulates, if you give it some thought, you can avoid it.
Okay. How often, if I want to get a dog and I have an apartment in the city, how often do I need to walk that dog?
Well, again, if you take it back to nature, actually, they probably only hunt once a day, or maybe once every few days. But they seriously don't need an actual long, active walk more than once a day, probably. Now, that doesn't mean they don't need to get out. They need to get out, stretch their legs, you know, spend a penny, do all that sort of stuff. That's English for have a wee.
Spend a penny.
Yeah.
I'm thinking, wow, they're shopping. Okay.
Yeah. And everybody else will understand that. But they do need the sort of daily walk. And the daily walk actually is a really useful psychologically as well, because a lot of people will take their dogs out to empty themselves, but don't take their dogs out for an active walk. Now, if you watch the dog's behavior, if you do actively walk it, they go nuts in excitement, apparently, at the walk. That's what you think they're doing. In fact, that's bonding behavior. So when they go nuts, they maybe attack each other in a sort of playful way. They bark a lot. They throw themselves about. That's absolute bonding behavior in the wild. They're all basically getting together as a pack, and they're saying, we're all pack members, and I know you, and you know me, and interacting. What you'll then notice is that when you take them out for the walk and you actually start walking, they go into a much more business-like sort of maneuver. That settles completely. So you can get as angry as you like about it, but the fact is it will settle as soon as you start walking, and they'll be in a much more business-like pose, and that's very natural again. That's very much, we're now going out, we're going for a hunt. Now, obviously, some dogs in rural areas and in wild bits of park will try and hunt, and I would, being very much a fan of wildlife, I would avoid them disturbing the wildlife. It's natural behavior for them to want to chase animals out there, sheep and wildfowl and things, but you obviously need to control that. That's our responsibility. And they don't have to do that, but they will want to go out sort of looking for things with you. And so hunting around in the long grass and things and running around is very natural behavior.
Okay, so practically, though, they do need to get out. So should I plan to have a dog walker come 3 times a day?
Well, if they need to be able to get out to empty themselves, so they need to get out to a bit of grass, yes, you've got to be able to let them out to do that, stretch their legs and whatever. But from the daily walk point of view, it only needs to be once a day, that longer walk. And what you'll notice is that once they've done that, the perfectly natural thing for them to do is rest. So they will, you know, in the wild, they'll go and disappear under a tree in the shade and rest. Mm-hmm. So it's incredibly, it's an important part of their day, which will, if it's done at a routine time, will keep them much more settled and much more relaxed and happy than if you didn't do it at all.
Do you think that routine time should be in the morning or at night?
Do you know, I don't think it actually matters. I think, again, to make things easier for city people, it needs to be at a routine time of day when the dog anticipates it, because yep. otherwise you're going to have a problem. So when people say to me, oh, my dog's always, every time I take it out, I can't let it off the lead because it goes off hunting, they don't routinely walk their dog. Almost all people I know who routinely walk their dog at a certain time of day will find that they can take their dogs out safely and they don't disappear off. The dog is expressing a need to be taken out and yep. on an adventure, as it were. And if you take it out and just let it go and it disappears off, that's the problem. So that's a training issue.
Okay. Okay. And the third question, what's the biggest mistake that people make when they get a dog in the city? So what's the biggest mismatch in terms of, I live in the city, I'm going to get a dog, and what are the things that you see in your practice? I know you're not a city vet, but you certainly know what you're talking about, that you think, gosh, I wish they had thought about that before they got this dog.
It's a great question, that. I think that requirement for exercise probably is the mm-hmm. biggest one. So taking on a breed that does need a lot of exercise, needs to be run around a lot, needs to be played with a lot, and a breed that doesn't. Do you know, the fascinating thing is your desire to have a greyhound. My experience of greyhounds that have come off the racetrack is that they become couch potatoes.
Do you know, I have heard that, actually, yeah. that they're quite lazy. So yeah. if I do get that one active walk in, I could conceivably yeah. Have them. The other thing that holds me back from having a dog is that we go down to France a lot, and I can't figure out, short of driving, it's a 2-day drive each way,
yeah,
how
sure.
I can get my dog, because they won't let dogs on trains, I don't think, on the Eurostar.
I don't know, but
I've got to look that up, yeah. actually. Maybe one of you guys
yeah,
out there
but
knows
the,
that.
But I think that's the biggest issue, is taking on an animal that needs more exercise than you've got time to give it.
So the point is, do your research. Talk to people.
Absolutely.
We've got resources out on catdogfish.com and also on our Facebook page, where you can really get some insight into that. So now I've got a dog. I take this dog out on a walk. How do I stop my dog from stopping every 2 feet and sniffing, eating, and drinking stuff on a city sidewalk that they shouldn't? And it pisses me off when I walk and I see people walking their dog and they yank the dog by the neck and they yank and yank, and I want to go over and yank them and smack them and say, you know, treat your dog a bit better than that. That is not necessarily the answer to what do you do to stop your dog from doing that.
Gabrielle Hayes, the Judge Dredd of
easily.
Control.
My husband hates walking with me because he's
control.
Like, don't go hurt that person.
So I think the first thing to say is that, again, look at what natural behavior is. Dogs are omnivorous scavengers and opportunists, and that's why they're such fantastic survivors. If you go anywhere in the world, it doesn't matter what level of development in the country, you will see dogs, street dogs, surviving fine. And that's because they do pick up every bit of rubbish and eat it. And rather unpleasantly, their stomach is a shopping bag from that respect. So they compete with other dogs. They will find something, they'll give it a quick sniff. Does that look like it might be useful and good to me? And if it is, they'll eat it. And they'll eat it and carry it back to a quiet place in their stomach. They then vomit it up and give it a slightly closer inspection and maybe give it a slightly slower and more considered chew and eat. So really unpleasant behavior, but they are they can vomit on command. They find it very easy just to pop the food back up. So vomiting isn't always a problem.
But shouldn't we dissuade them from doing this?
Well, exactly. So the issue comes then that every bit of rubbish off the street isn't necessarily the best food for your dog, and it could cause gastroenteritis, and you might end up with a genuine vomiting problem or diarrhea problem. And there could be nasty bacteria in the food that they found. Not least, people aren't always that careful with discarding things like chicken bones, and mm-hmm. those can be cooked. Chicken bones are definitely dangerous to dogs, because if they splinter, then they can puncture the lung, the gut, and cause them a major issue. So yes, you should dissuade them from doing that. And you're almost certainly right that the only real way of being able to do that is either physical restraint. So you've got something on them. Now, I would prefer that thing to be a harness rather than a neck collar. Harness, or if they're a big dog and they're difficult because they're pulling, there's a thing called a haltie, or other versions are available, a sort of halter type thing, which isn't going to be pulling on their neck. So that's what I prefer. A neck collar is a useful way of attaching ID to the dog. Mm-hmm. And in a well-behaved dog, it's a good way of just keeping some control over them. But if you've got a dog that pulls, or a dog that you need to pull away from things a lot, then I would recommend it's done on a harness. The other way of doing it, if you've got a dog that's a really bad scavenger and you want to be able to let it off in the park, is actually put a muzzle on it.
Oh, so you put it. Just feels so wrong.
Well, if it's a cage muzzle, although cage muzzles look worse than the muzzles used to sort of prevent dogs biting in the vets. The cage muzzle will allow it to open its mouth and pant and do all the natural things. And if it's not rubbing, it's probably not causing it any problems, and it'll stop it eating every bit of rubbish. So it's another way of preventing them from eating.
And it's humane.
Yeah, absolutely. Cage muzzles. There are people who have dogs that will attack other dogs. That's happened. Some dogs are very defensive of their pack, and they will attack other dogs. The best way to protect other dogs from attack is to ensure that your dog is muzzled so it can't damage other dogs. Now, it's still frightening to have a dog that's meaning harm running towards your dog, but if you see it's got a muzzle on, at least you know your dog's not going to come to any harm. So yes, I'm absolutely happy with cage muzzles, and I think that they are a good thing to use if you've got a dog that does this sort of thing. The other thing to say is that dogs can be trained not to do that. So you can use positive endorsement training sort of with clickers and things. And I can't go into that, but you can certainly go to dog trainers or look it up. And
we've got our cat dog fish experts. We've got two wonderful dog trainers on our experts page, and Nick and Mark. And we'll have them on the podcast too. And we'll go into more of these kinds of things.
Sure.
But yes, getting them on side is, I think, a pretty important thing.
If every time they look at a bit of rubbish, sort of a McDonald's packet or whatever on the road, you click and give them a reward for coming to you and having a reward rather than going to pick up the McDonald's packet, they'll soon realize that actually it's better just to ignore the rubbish.
So like most things, it's investing in training.
Exactly.
Good. Okay. Well, those are just a few of the questions that we've been asked. We will definitely return to this topic and keep answering more. But we've run out of time for now. But we are going to end today's podcast by taking a look at a piece of pet tech that has caught our attention. We have no relationship with this company. We have not used it ourselves, but like anything, we're passing judgment simply by virtue of looking at it on the website. So this one is called the
Firepaw Dog Treadmill.
Okay, Chris, what do you think about this?
So I think this, again, this is worth a look because they've got some great videos of these dogs using this. This is a free flow treadmill. So when I say free flow, it doesn't have any mechanism in it to drive it. So it's not like the ones that those lazy people use in gyms, which actually drive themselves and you just have to move your legs up and down and you go somewhere. The dog actually drives this, but it's on a very frictionless surface. So it spins very quickly. Now, the one thing that the video didn't show is how the dogs stop. And there were some dogs going really very fast on these things. And I just wondered how what the incentive was for slowing down and whether they just fell flat on their face like they
humans.
Were on ice. Exactly. So I did. I had a bit of concern there. And I had a bit of concern looking. They were made of slatted wood, the surface. And I had a bit of concern that actually once it's worn a bit and the joints between the wood might open up a bit and you might find that claws get caught in them, and if a claw got caught in there it would break. So that was a little bit of concern. Now I'm maybe reassured on that. Do you know what, I just looked at it and I just thought, you know, get out and walk your dog. I mean, you know, so many people waddle their way down to the shops, get some more food, and then, oh, yeah, the dog's still on the treadmill. Take the dog out, you know, and maybe even run with it yourself. It's bound to do the world of good. It does say very heavily on the website that this is not a substitute for walking your dog, which means they've already worked out that that's the criticism of it, and they are hitting that head out. And yes, definitely people will use this as a substitute for walking their dog. And I think that's really sad.
I agree.
A dog going nowhere, just like all those other people going nowhere in sweaty rooms up and down the country.
An anti-gym bias we are hearing from Dr. Chris Tufnell. All right. Well, thanks very much for joining us today. And please let us know what you think. Email gabrielle@catdogfish.com. Visit the website for links to these and some references that we've mentioned in the podcast. And also let us know what you'd like us to talk about next time. Thanks.
Thanks, Gab.
For information on how to take expert care of your pet, go to catdogfish.com.